Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We're live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise, informative update. It's Thursday, March the 28th. Coming up on the program, why inflation remains a pressing concern. The electricity minister talks to us on load shedding and aging power stations. Why we don't read political party manifestos. Is business giving up on skills development? And bones, stolen art, and a famous exhibition. As expected, interest rates were left unchanged for a fifth consecutive Monetary Policy Committee meeting. The decision was unanimous, according to the South African Reserve Bank governor, who said that risks, though, remain to South Africa's inflation expectations. First up on the program from PwC, Klantye Pai, a very warm welcome to you. Let's assume that the decision by the Reserve Bank governor was expected, but what is worrying are current inflation trends. What right now are the primary factors contributing to this? Where does the risk lie?
Hello, Jeremy. It's very good to speak to you. They lie in a number of areas. The main thing that has been really, really of serious concern is what we call core inflation, because headline inflation, while it has increased, that is something that we've been expecting because of the volatility that we see in energy prices, certainly that we see also in food prices. We know that there's also big concerns around the shortages in grain. So that's something that's on the outlook that could increase food prices, especially certain kinds of food. But where there's been an expectation that we can actually have an anchored inflation is that core inflation. So that's when we remove those very volatile energy and food prices, and we actually are left then with sort of that core part that is usually more stable. We see that increasing after it had actually stayed low for quite some time, and that's something of very, very serious concern. But it may very well reflect what we are seeing in terms of the value chains and some of those blockages that we've seen in our ports. Perhaps there's shortages in the system in terms of the right kinds of foodstuffs rather than demand. So that's probably one area where we are seeing that. But of course, we know that the volatility globally is something that we are worried about, that may very well affect the exchange rate, and that's something also that we are looking at on the outlook. And then, of course, we know that we have not yet seen the worst in terms of that Middle East crisis, and certainly what is still happening globally. So the global pressures are still there outside of that. And then lastly, we're still also obviously contending very much with energy, and still very much contending with the issues around the port, so logistics. So there's still very much a lot of things that could affect prices, that many of them have already done so.
And there is a domino impact here when it comes to business, particularly in terms of borrowing and expansion.
There is certainly, and this is one of the key concerns, because some businesses are already struggling on the demand side, but there's also the ability, the cost of borrowing is something of serious concern, especially when we think about some of the positive things that are coming from the government side. Remember, Jeremy, that one of the key areas are these collaborations between the public and the private sector, and some of the opportunities that are starting to emerge in terms of infrastructure development, and some of the opportunities that some businesses are saying, look, if we look to the outlook, there's a positivity. One of the things we've done, we do at PwC, is this CEO survey. And they seem, the CEOs were starting to see some positive impetus, whereas in previous years, there's been actually a negative outlook. They're starting to see positivity. When you see that, you want to obviously be able to borrow and be able to invest. But obviously, if the cost of borrowing or the cost of money is high, then obviously that is something that will hold business back.
And given that we are continually held hostage by exogenous factors, it's difficult to implement domestic measures that would bring the rate of inflation under control.
Certainly, as you quite rightly say, that some of the domestic issues that we need also very much are obviously concerned to local measures. I think one of the interesting things, just if we look even at the mining sector that has been under a lot of pressure, Jeremy, and that mining sector, of course, is also connected to other industries. So if we're looking at the financial sector, the infrastructure that also goes with mining, but we know that the ex externally. Commodity prices have softened because of the growth environment that we are facing globally. And that means then that the opportunities locally are they not open for us to be able to actually do the right kind of investment. So then domestically, there is certainly that impact. And it's an impact that is really regrettable because we are looking for some sort of opportunities to start to invest locally and to start to actually find some green shoots, especially in the immediate term.
And I'm correct in saying that the decision yesterday and the commentary is also a subtle shaking of the head to government. Does it signal anything about the Reserve Bank's confidence in current economic strategy?
As they have always said, and they continue to say that much of the hard lifting cannot come from the Reserve Bank. It must come from the reforms that government must undertake, and it must come from the implementation of those reforms, the acceleration of reforms. Now we know with Operation Phakisa that we have seen, not sorry, Operation Vulindlela. We've seen that many of these reforms have been undertaken on paper, and that's positive because we needed to take everybody along. But what we need now is actually the rolling out of that kind of infrastructure, the implementation, for example, of some of the things that we've been promised in the budget, certainly in some of the State of the Nation addresses, that really unlock the potential of the economy because that is really where we are. That interest rates, even if you start to lower interest rates, which we've seen before, that seems not to take off because obviously it has to take off at an environment where the government has actually been able to optimize the environment and the policy space, and certainly some of its own spending that attracts private sector spending in a manner that actually lowers the risk to the private sector. And that's something that the private sector has been asking for. But it's not hopeless because at least we've walked a much longer road in terms of actually trying to ease and soften some of the bottlenecks that have been there, at least on paper.
Monty Pye from PwC, thank you very much for joining me and have a good Easter weekend.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Electricity Minister, José Enzo Ramachopa, says six power stations need immediate attention as the winter months approach. He's been on another power station tour, this time to Kendal. He joins us now on the program. And Minister, welcome to you. Is any progress being made then regarding these stations?
Oh, thank you very much, Jeremy. Maybe just to make the point that the choice of the six power station is on a basis of really two things. The first one is that they are some of our biggest power stations, so per unit they pack anything between 500 to 600 megawatts. And because they have about 5 to 6 units, so you can get anything between 3,000 to 3,600 megawatts. But these are stations that are underperforming from a reliability point of view and also from the partial losses point of view. So our view is that if we were to make an effort in concentrating on those, we can get an exceptionally high amount of megawatt. Then there are stations that are much, much older. So those are mid-age. So they're about 35 years of age. They still have 10 to 15 years of life left in them from, if you like, their design philosophy. And then you have much older one. You had Arnold Camden. They pack per unit about 180 megawatts. So those are the ones that are in line to retire earlier than these six that we have identified. Remember, the kind of improvements that we are likely going to make will require money. So you wouldn't want to put money into a station that will be retired in the next 3 to 5 years. So really, that was a choice.
Right.
But we are seeing that even in the much, much older power station, Camden, for an example, Arnold and Fruit Flake, they continue to perform, dispelling the myth that the older you get, the lower the performance, the lower the output. I think that we've been able to illustrate that really there is no direct correlation. Of course, there are factors that could undermine performance, but we have chosen these six because we think that we can get a significant amount of megawatts to help us to get out of a very, very, very difficult situation, Jeremy.
Minister, you talk about effort being required then as far as these power stations are concerned. What effort are you talking about, and where are your concerns? Where do the risks remain?
Oh, yes, absolutely correct. So the first one is that we have seen that there are legacy issues. So I think over the past 3 to 4 years, there's been significant underinvestments in these machines. And as a result of objective factors, there's been a deterioration of the Eskom balance sheet. Subjective factors, we know that those have been laid bare at the Zondo Commission, the issues of corruption, malfeasance, and leakage. So you had to address the leadership issues at these power stations. And that starts at the top, stabilize the board. And we're glad that Dr. Mketo and his team at the board level have accepted this responsibility. They made inspired appointments at the GM level or executive level responsible for generation, chosen someone from within the ranks of Eskom, exceptional experience, Mr. Begging Numalo. And he subsequently also stabilized, if you like, leadership at the station level. Went and looked for colleagues with exceptional experience, impeccable credentials from within, deployed them to Tuka, Mata, Kendal, Krill, and Pusile, and we're beginning to see this effort. The second one was in the discipline of how you contract with original equipment manufacturers. I always make the point, if you drive a car of a particular make, let's say Toyota, for an example, if you need to take it to the workshop for a regular checkup, maintenance, whatever you choose to call it, you wouldn't take it to a different make. So it is important that we strengthen the relationship with the big four original equipment manufacturers because they can give you guarantees. They know these machines. They are the ones who manufacture these machines. So we bedded that with the original equipment manufacturers. The third one was the procurement environment, the speed and agility of how you procure. In many instances, these machines will be offload or not online as a result of spares not being available at the workshop because of the inordinate amount of time that it takes for you to procure, the regulations that determine how you conduct yourself in the procurement environment. Now we have engaged with National Treasury to say, let's create a bespoke solution that is specific to the challenges of Eskom without undermining transparency, competitiveness, and also accountability. So we've bedded those. And then there's issues of coal procurement. So those are the four big areas that have received attention, and we're beginning to see that the results are bearing fruit in some of the stations. There's two power stations that are still lagging behind. We're not where we want to be. Kendal and Tutuka, the notorious for not helping us in the recovery effort. But we're confident that with the leadership that is there, will turn the corner at some point, Jeremy.
Well, at some point, you know, I think people would want a firmer timeline as far as that is concerned, given that you've just sounded another warning over winter load shedding.
No, absolutely correct. Just to be specific, Kendal will be retaining all of the units. We had there when I went to Kendal just the other day, only 3 units were online, and they gave me the assurance that the one unit was going to come online, I think the following day it has indeed come online, and then there are 2 other units that will come online by mid-April. This will be for the first time in like 18 months that we've had 6 units running at Kendal. Tutuka has been running on 1 out of 6 units for a considerable period of time. 2 of those units are coming online by end of April, the other ones really towards the end of the year. So the point I'm making is that from those 2 power stations, 3,000 megawatts will come on stream by end of April.
Minister, you talk about the engagement with Treasury in a transparent way, all well and good, and obviously you have to talk a positive game here. But let me suggest to you that your biggest problem still is going to find funding to enable the improvements that you want to implement. And that becomes more difficult given the reputation that Eskom has at the moment.
Well, we are lucky that we have been able to succeed in making a case before National Treasury that if you don't resolve load shedding, then the economy really will continue to collapse, and therefore our revenue generating ability gets to be eroded, and therefore the national fund, if you like, the fiscus will continue to drain, and therefore you will not be able to carry out all other investments in social infrastructure. So there's a correlation between the elimination of load shedding and the performance of the economy. And National Treasury has come on board, gave us that 254 fiscal injection. And that's why I'm able to talk with a degree of confidence about the investments that we are making in that space on the back of that fiscal injection. And of course, beyond that fiscal injection, we are looking at other creative ways of what is the best way of tapping into the liquidity that's sitting with the private sector for the kind of investments that is required without necessarily relinquishing state ownership of this asset, be it transmission, distribution, or generation. We're making significant headway on the transmission side. We'll design other solutions also on the generation side. But where we are, the 254 fiscal injection will take us a long way. So we'll work within those parameters, Jeremy.
Minister Ramakgopa, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The rapid development of skills in the workplace remains a thorn in the side of the economy, and unless this is done with greater speed, we're going to have problems. The national wheel spinning, so to speak, is going to continue. Someone who has a strong view on this and possibly some solutions is Nsapokazi Madipi, who is founder of the Entrepreneurs Development Forum, and joins me now on the program. So let me ask you bluntly, are you despondent about the pace?
Yeah, I am despondent about the rate and the, you know, the red tape that exists. I think one of the things that we haven't really done well is to define who is an entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship and, or entrepreneurs rather, and small businesses, they are used interchangeably. And I think it's important for us to make the distinction between entrepreneurs and actually small businesses, because I do make mention in the article that we need to have that distinction. And I think this also emanates from the fact that we view entrepreneurship as a business, whereas I can be an entrepreneur coming up with a solution, but not necessarily be the individual that actually takes that solution to the market. So I can be the problem solver that really sees what is a problem and actually generate a solution, but ask someone who has the capabilities and the skills required by the market to actually take solution to the market. So I think we are very slow because we are seeing it only as this thing that you need to be selling something. We are not looking from it from the perspective of solving some of these critical problems that we have.
So how do you think we can best break the logjam in as quick a time as possible?
I think we need to integrate it in the curriculum, but also we need to develop programs that will be taken to communities, because entrepreneurship usually starts at community level. And immediately when you tell someone that you need to start a business, you get a mind block because you think, what business am I going to start? But when you present entrepreneurship as saying, go and see a problem in your community and come up with solutions to that, then that's much more, you get to be much more receptive in understanding what are the problems that we have in our communities and how can we mobilize and come up with resources to actually solve some of those problems.
So who does this? How do you start that mobilization then? is it an issue around teaching better at schools? Is it more community cohesion? Or is there a role for business itself to perhaps drop a level and help people find those opportunities?
Yes. So I think firstly, it's about knowledge. So we can't start businesses if we don't have knowledge of what it is that is wrong, right? So I think it starts with the knowledge. And that's why I feel entrepreneurship embedded in education will really allow and empower people to be able to be these problem solvers. But also on the other side, we as the people, as society, as the youth, we need to see ourselves as the solution, because entrepreneurship is not something that falls out of the sky. It's initiated by individuals. And that's why it's always important to actually start empowering the individual and ensure that they've got all the capabilities, all the knowledge, all the skills that are required in order for them to execute some of these solutions. And then when we're looking at businesses, I think businesses play a huge role in empowering some of these entrepreneurs. And also it then becomes a responsibility both from the people who are starting businesses and the existing businesses to say, how do we form partnerships that will then empower you to actually start and run these businesses in your communities without big businesses having to compete with these entrepreneurs, right? So I think we need to find a way of how do we develop those private-public partnership also embedding civil society. Because I think when we look at South Africa and the African region at large, some of the challenges that we have are socioeconomic issues. And in order for us to solve for those socioeconomic issues, the drivers of those changes have to be the people who are actually experiencing some of these issues that we have.
And let me suggest to you that in theory, that sounds great. But when it comes to the public-private partnership concept, yes, businesses might turn around and say, look, we're at full throttle here and we're busy focusing on our own survival. We simply don't have time for outreach.
Yes. Well, that is true. I think in development, we need to look at it in a holistical manner. Because the reality is that the people that are struggling in South Africa and that need to actually be the drivers of these entrepreneurial ventures are people who don't have the capital. So it then becomes a responsibility from the businesses to see how do we ensure that we play part in development. And also, I think when we look at entrepreneurship, we look at skills. And one of the ways that we need to look at this public-private partnership is to give big businesses the responsibility to say, if we don't have the skills in-house as a country, you need to look at how do you empower the people in-house rather than going out and exporting some of the skills that we don't have as a country. So I think it's something that needs to be legislated to say businesses need to be intentional in ensuring that they develop the human capital in South Africa to ensure that we actually reach where we are supposed to go.
But business might turn around and say, what's in it for me? Do they need to be better incentivized, maybe from a tax perspective?
I think so. Those are some of the discussions, of course, that we need to look into. But I think, honestly, we cannot develop if businesses are only doing their own thing, while the people who are consumers, because remember, when you are looking at all of these people that are starting these businesses, they are still consumers of big businesses. So we need to find common ground to say it's not only about profit, but let's look at how do we then empower these people so that we can all benefit from some of the offering that are in South Africa.
Thank you very much for joining me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let's pivot now to politics. And our next guest says South African voters are facing what can only be described as a voter dilemma as they remain confused and fatigued by failed promises from multiple political parties over the years. Ezekiel Kakana is a researcher at the Helen Suzman Foundation. Welcome to you. And why have you raised this issue?
Because, Jeremy, I've heard so many South Africans say that they don't know who to vote for. They want to vote, but they don't know who to vote for. And that's because we have so many political parties and now we'll have also independent candidates. So they don't know because all of them seem to be speaking the same language of promising. So I've realized that many of them are facing that dilemma as to who they should vote for. And I suggest that maybe by going through manifestos of all political parties and independents and reading what is it that they are saying that they will do, and also aligning their own personal needs with those manifestos will help them to find who they can potentially vote for.
I want to talk to you about manifestos in just a moment. But the fact that the situation exists, this confusion, do you think it's because political parties generally have run out of ideas, or are they simply not explaining their ideas in such a way that people, voters, will understand them?
I think I will say that most political parties have realized or have realized for quite some time now that people don't necessarily read their manifestos. That's why they make these empty promises. And I believe that if people go through those manifestos, they'll be able to whether understand if political parties or independent candidates are really saying that which they say they will do. Because manifestos clearly tells a voter as to how a political party or an independent candidate will do what they promise they will do.
The trouble, of course, is that so many manifestos are difficult to read and most people just don't bother to do so.
Yeah, and that's a problem. I think that's what I'm trying to encourage South Africans to just go through manifestos. I mean, we do have many political parties. I mean, some political parties have written manifestos that are just a couple of pages. And I think those are manifestos that are more readable. Even those that have more pages, I will encourage voters to just go through them because at times they tend to help voters to make a proper decisions about a party and independent candidate.
What do you think the best way is to read a manifesto?
By just going through a manifesto, looking at what are your own personal needs and see if those manifestos have those personal needs. Let me give an example, Jeremy. I come from Limpopo in a village where there's no access to water. So if I go through a manifesto and I see that a political party or independent candidate is promising to provide access to water to voters, I will easily vote for that party because it speaks to the needs or my personal needs.
The trouble, of course, is that political parties are all pretty much saying the same thing about the big issues, and that makes the job more difficult.
Yeah, I agree. But I think in most cases, if you go through a manifesto and look at what the political party is saying they will do, because most of the time politicians tend to make promises without explaining how they will do them. But if you go through manifestos, at times they have a proper way of detailing how they will be able to do that and how they will be able to find money in funding those priorities or promises.
Do you think that politicians at a time like this are accessible enough to voters?
They are, because, I mean, this time is when politicians will go doing door-to-door to voters. I think they are more accessible to voters.
But it's all very stage managed. That's the problem, isn't it?
It is, because they're doing it just for the votes. So that's why I suggest that people should not necessarily listen to what they say, but go through their manifestos. Because I believe that through manifestos, that's where people will be able to understand that which the politicians are promising them.
Okay, Ezekiel, you're making a very strong case for manifestos. Let me come back at you and say that those manifestos are not always easily accessible to people.
That's very true. That's very true. But I've seen a lot of websites where, especially the People Assembly, there's website whereby people can just see different manifestos in one. So you go to the website and it has all different political parties' manifestos and also independent candidates. So I would suggest and encourage people to visit such sites where there's just, you know, access of all information with regard to manifestos.
Do you think that political parties talk enough interrogatively about the important issues instead of just attacking each other, which is what they seem to do more and more, particularly the closer we come to the election?
And this one thing that I've observed, that most of the political parties, and in this case I'll mention opposition parties, they tend to talk more about the failures of the ANC or of the ruling party more than telling the voters that which they will do. So I think this culture of just attacking each other without necessarily talking to the voters about that which you're bringing to the table, it has to come to an end, because people want to know that which you will bring to them or which you are promised to them, more than just you are taking each other for political gains.
The problem, of course, is it's the attacking rhetoric that gets the headlines. It's a lot more interesting than just hearing about policy.
That's true. And that's why I will again encourage voters, instead of just listening to political parties attacking each other, go through their manifestos and see what is it that they are promising you as a voter.
Just a final one. Do you think it's a good idea that independent candidates are now going to feature on the ballot for the first time, or is this simply going to confuse matters even more?
I think it's a good idea to have independent candidates, because for quite some time we had political parties that will run alone, and those parties at times when they get to be elected, we don't even know who are the people who are representing us in parliament. But with independent candidates now, you'll be able to know that this person is representing me as a voter, because I directly voted for him, rather than me voting for a party and a party give me someone that I don't even know or trust.
Ezekiel Kakana from the Helen Suzman Foundation, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And let's finish the program on a philosophical note. Acclaimed South African sculptor, poet and writer Patika Ntuli is shining the light of African heritage and culture with a body of work that focuses on what is termed returning to the source. Something to ponder ahead of the Easter weekend. It's a long-running exhibition. Curator is Ruzi Rusike, who joins us now. Ruzi, a very warm welcome to Source, or returning to the source. What was the motivation for it, and why has this exhibition found such traction, do you think?
So thank you very much for allowing me to participate on this platform. Essentially, the exhibition was born out of COVID-19 and within the pandemic. And what happened is that with the Grahamstown Art Festival, there was a call to exhibit, and they were honoring Prof. Patika Ntuli. And with that, we had another titled in relationship to the anomaly of basically being a civilian in society. But then we thought that, what is it when you return to something? And what is it that when you want to platform art? And what is it when you're platforming bone works in particular? So instead of limiting it to the narrative of it being a civilian, we wanted to expand it to both the realm of spirituality and also the consciousness, both in a level of being consciously and unconscious, I guess.
And how should people then be engaging with the exhibition?
I think that with art, with the language of art, there's always a separation. Or when people talk about art, they always think about them, the artist, and then themselves. So how they should actually approach this exhibition is that you should see yourself reflected in the artworks. And if you don't, then it should be a challenge then. And what Prof does via Azibuyile Emeseswini, Return to the Source, he even challenges how language then is able to conjure up different emotive understandings of oneself, but also how we place ourselves within certain things. For example, Pritik and I come from different generations, and that in itself is a statement. And me being the curator and him being the artist, we needed to come to a point of understanding what is it that we want the exhibition to say, and specifically through bone works, which for a long time, due to colonization, and specifically African artists working with bone works, it was always framed within a specific time frame. So then even when we think of time, we also challenge that as well. So there's different levels in which one can approach the exhibition. It's just about how you see yourself within the exhibition. So that's why the exhibition is a call to actually participate in the exhibition. And that's why Prof put out a call to over 30 different thought leaders, both poets, artists, politicians, etc. So, yeah.
And just finally, as I mentioned, it's a long-running exhibition. Where do we find it now?
So currently it's at the Durban Art Gallery, and beforehand it was at Leeuwenhuis in Bloemfontein. And right now the choice of Durban Art Gallery is that with the landscapes of art, it's always centralized to Johannesburg and Cape Town. So we're taking it to spaces where usually people are always left out of the narrative. So currently at the Durban Art Gallery, it's there. It's for an extended amount of time. And it's also going to be in conversation with, I hope, Articulate Durban. So, yes, you can find it currently at the Durban Art Gallery.
And if you happen to be in the city, as I have done, it is well worth a visit. Ruzi Rasika, thank you very much indeed, curator of the exhibition. And I think that's a good place to leave the program for today. Just a quick reminder about our online poll yesterday. The fate of the speaker, should she resign? Special leave is enough. I have confidence in the investigation. And boy, this was emphatic. Close on 90% of our respondents saying the speaker should pack her bags. I'm going to leave you now. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Have a wonderful Easter weekend. We're back on Tuesday. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.